Again to badquaker.com podcast. Today is Monday, May 28th, 2012, and my name is Ben Stone. I want to start out the day talking about email a little bit. I've had some really good email responses, and I wanted to talk about that a little bit. I woke up last Friday, and I wasn't going to do a podcast. Sometimes I get hit with quite a bit of arthritis pain, and I'm not saying that to get sympathy. I'm, you know, just strictly using it as an excuse. But I really wasn't feeling good, so I thought, okay, I'm not going to do a podcast today. I can't stand to sit here for an hour and talk to a microphone. It's just too much pain. And after a little while, I checked my email, and I had an email that was so inspiring that it made me want to just sit down and do a podcast. So I started to do that, and then one thing rammed into the next thing, and it was just a series of events, and I never got to do that podcast Friday. So I guess, you know, that just wasn't in the cards for Friday. But anyway, I did have the enjoyment of several really good emails coming in both Friday and over the weekend, and I wanted to read a couple of them, I'll only actually read one of them for you, but I got some emails on my Gary North question. I had asked the question of why there's so much hate being thrown towards Gary North, and I also had some response on Facebook on the same question, and as best as I can tell, and I'm really thinking that this really is the case, it appears that the hate towards Gary North is coming from his somewhat radical Christian beliefs, especially some of his beliefs that he espoused during the 1980s. I don't know if he still holds to those really what seem like radical statist beliefs to me, but maybe I just don't understand his position thoroughly. But it appears as though that's where the hate is coming from on Gary North for his religious beliefs. And, well, you know, I had a moral problem with a person once, and I was talking to another person that I had a great respect for them, and they said, the person I had a problem with was my doctor, and I had a moral problem with some of his behavior, some of his not his behavior with me. I'm trying to be as vague as possible so that I don't indict anyone, but I had some problems with the doctor's behavior, not in reference to me, but in reference to other people. And so I was talking to a friend about this, a friend that I have a lot of respect for, and he said, well, look, if you had an auto mechanic who was, a serious drunkard, and but every time he worked on your car, he did the work perfectly, would you not go to the auto mechanic because he was a drunkard? Or would you take your car to him because the reason you're going to him is to get your car fixed, and he's the best there is at fixing the car? And I said, well, I guess I would just take my car to him. And he said, well, it's the same thing with your doctor. Your doctor may not be the perfect person that you want him to be, but none of us are. But if he's supplying what you want from him, then that's pretty much all you can really request from him. So if we do this, if we look at the same thing with Gary North, you know, let's assume that he still holds to these radical religious beliefs from his books of the 80s. Well, that doesn't mean he's not a good economist. That doesn't mean he doesn't know, you know, that doesn't mean that we can't glean from him certain information from his years and years of experience and his vast knowledge of what he's learned. It may mean that we don't agree with him on everything, but then again, I don't know of anybody that I agree with 100%. I talk quite a bit about Robert Higgs because he's one of the people that I know that I have a tremendous amount of respect for, and I agree with almost everything Robert Higgs has said that I have read or that I've heard, and yet there's little things that he and I disagree with, and you know. So, and I use Robert Higgs as an example because Bob is about the, you know, maybe one of the nicest people I've ever known and one of the smartest people that I've ever known. And yet there are things that I disagree with him on. So, you know, so with Gary North, I'm sure if I sat down and I've never spoke with Gary North, but I'm sure if I did, I would find lots of things I disagree with him on, and most specifically, I'm sure many of those things would revolve around religion. So, you know, I can't really, unless there's something else that people know about Gary North other than his radical religious beliefs, I can't really hold that against him. I can't, as one person said, treat him as a non-person. I can't do that just because he has some radical religious beliefs. Okay, now I want to get to another email that came to me. I'm going to read this one because it was just, I really liked this email. It says, Ben, I think your framing of the use of political means as a temptation is quite apt. Your podcast prompted me to think further about some things that have been on my mind for a while now, especially following my own deviation back into politics with the current Ron Paul campaign. I think the use of the political means for the intended achievement of freedom or at least less intrusive government, takes primarily two forms. One, people who accept some type of state but generally want a smaller one, so they naturally see no flaw with using the political means to try to do this. These are the Ron Paul supporters who were previously apolitical, but with no deep understanding of the system they rightfully hate, as well as those on the left or the right who feel disenfranchised and have rejected party politics, but have not yet accepted the non-aggression principle, and it also includes libertarian-leaning Tea Party folks, constitutionalists, and minarchist libertarians who believe only in getting government back to its proper size and role. You know, that's in quotes, proper size and role. This is an issue of philosophy primarily. These people have either not thought things through all the way to their logical ends, are confused about freedom, or simply believe when it comes down to it that aggression is in some instances, justified. However, the second group is a different situation. These are the tempted. And now we've got group two. Two, libertarians who reject the state and who deep down know that political means cannot be successful in dismantling the state, yet they deny it and choose not to let go of political means for what I think is primarily an emotional reason. These libertarians realize they will, in all likelihood, not see the end of the state or the achievement of a stateless society in their lifetimes. So they're tempted into political recourse to attempt to achieve less tyranny in their lifetime rather than eventually full freedom for the future. In essence, they're trading long-term goals for short-term gains without realizing that this will always backfire and make the process towards true freedom that much longer and harder. And while doing this, many end up believing they actually could eventually achieve true freedom this way. I feel this is one of the main reasons anarchist libertarians get drawn into thinking politics can be a solution, and why many minarchists are still minarchists. They criticize the politicians in Washington for sacrificing the wealth of future, for sacrificing the wealth and future of their children and grandchildren without realizing, as harsh as it may sound, that in a way they're doing the same thing, albeit with infinitely better intentions. I think they are allowing themselves to be tricked, half out of misplaced hopefulness and half out of the desperation to have freedom now, or even more short-sightedly thinking they can prevent the crash or even more short-sightedly thinking they can prevent the crash that's around the corner, forgetting or not understanding that it has to come and cannot be stopped, as tragic as that is. I can't in good conscience call these people selfish, since I cannot fault anyone for simply desiring freedom for themselves, which is in itself wonderful. Unfortunately, no get-free-quick scheme will ever really work, and you can't force people to be free. For the world to save itself. I agree with you that the state will die only when the market for it. Oh, I see. I'll try that again. I agree with you that the state will die only when the market for it dies, and only then. There are no shortcuts to freedom. And that's from Andrew. Thanks, Andrew. I really appreciate that email. And that really was true. I don't even know what I could add to that. I just really appreciate that email. I got another email from a longtime listener, Graham, and he pointed me towards a YouTube video that, I could really talk about this thing for a while, but I will too. If I can remember it, I'll put a link. I'm arguing with myself here on the microphone, but if I can remember, I'll put a link to this YouTube video on the page where this podcast appears. But the pertinent section of the video, and it's a fairly long video, the pertinent section is only around a minute long. And what's going on in the video is that this is in Chicago, at the beach at Chicago. And rather than being down in the Occupy movement with the marches and everything, some of the Ron Paul supporters from, I can't remember the name of the organization, but it's on the link. It's the Super PAC. It's the big Ron Paul Super PAC. I can't remember their name. Anyway, they're the ones that put on this video, and they've got the man on the street type reporter walking around the beach outside of Chicago, talking to people, mostly young people, and getting their opinions and so forth. And the Ron Paul supporter walks up to a lady who admits that she is a socialist. And then the Ron Paul supporter begins talking to her about the Federal Reserve. And this takes place from time marks 19 minutes, 18 seconds to 10 minutes, 20 seconds. So it's like a minute to 2 seconds long. It's really, that part of it is really short, but the video itself, I think, is closer to maybe close to 20 minutes long. But that section, I wrote that down wrong. It can't be 19 to 10. It's got to be, I'll figure it out and put the notes on the website for it. But it starts at the 19 minutes and 18 second mark, and I think it's only like a minute or two long where the guy says this stuff. But what he basically does in talking to the socialist lady is he lays out what he's portraying as Ron Paul's solution to the problem with the Federal Reserve. Well, in actuality, what he's laying out is not anything even remotely similar to what Ron Paul has ever said that I've ever heard. What he lays out is the standard greenbacker argument. And now it's important to realize this, because I've said this before, these greenbacker people are actively pushing their way into the libertarian movement and actively pushing their way into the Ron Paul supporters and vigorously trying to educate people onto their side for this. And if you don't think this is really important, then I think you're not really understanding the difference between capitalism and socialism, between a free market and a market controlled by the elite. Now, that's really what we're talking about here. Greenbackers, whether they realize it or not, are pushing socialism. And they're pushing socialism in the most fundamental way. The control of the means of production, central control or central planning of the means of production, is socialism. Anything else that you might imagine in your mind that might be socialism is secondary or doesn't apply at all. It's according to what it is you're imagining in your mind. But the primary description of socialism is the central planning or the central control of the means of production. And money is the primary means of production in any economy. Okay, so whoever controls money controls the economy. If the Federal Reserve or any central bank, in conjunction with, when in the case of the United States today, the Federal Reserve is a private, privately held corporation. So when you have a privately held corporation that has made an arrangement with the federal government, then you have the means of production in a fascist system. You have this marriage between government and corporations produces a fascist a monetary system, and that's what we have today. We've had it since 1913. The Federal Reserve is a fascist system, and by that I don't mean guys with tall boots and mustaches and marching and all this kind of nonsense like that. That's not fascism. Fascism is when the government utilizes a relationship with the corporations, and the corporations utilize their relationship with government, and they control the means of production between them. It's sort of where the government pollutes the market, and the market pollutes the government. And, you know, and that's basically what we've had since 1913, to a certain extent even before that. But once they got control of the money supply in 1913 in the form of the Fed, that's what we've had. So that is today. We have a fascist system with the Federal Reserve today. But what this person in this video and what all greenbackers support is to eliminate the Federal Reserve altogether and then have Congress use the Treasury as a bank. And Congress then issues money, whether in the form of a bank like in the little girl, the video that I was ranting about a week or two ago, whatever it was, about the little girl from Canada where they had her mouth certain words and spit out the greenback blather. Whether we're talking about a central bank in Canada doing that, or whether we're talking about the actual Treasury doing it, or whether we're talking about Congress just issuing it by law. One way or the other, when the government controls the money supply, that's called socialism. That's what socialism is. It's the government managing, controlling, and planning the economy. And the means of production, in this case, is money. Money is the primary means of production. So when you have the government controlling the money supply and setting interest rates, you have a socialist government. So these people, whether they're Ron Paul supporters or whether they're claiming to be libertarians or whether they're just confused, whether they know it or not, they are actively infiltrating the Ron Paul campaigns, and they're actively infiltrating libertarians. And libertarians need to open their eyes and look at this. You are being actively polluted by socialists who are bringing socialist, the very foundational socialist ideas, and selling them as libertarianism. You really need to open your eyes and look at this. This is a serious pollution of the movement. You can't have the primary means of production controlled by the government as your goal and still call yourself a libertarian. The two things are opposite of each other. That's like me holding a gun and saying that I hate guns and would never touch one. It's self-contradictory. You can't be a greenbacker. Now, I don't want to sound like Walter Block, where he's like, if you don't support Ron Paul, you're not a libertarian. Well, no, that's stupid. That's just a stupid statement on the part of Walter Block. But I can say this: you can't stand on the bottom of the ocean and be dry. You know, you can't say that you're a Republican and then vote Democrat at every single election. These things, there are lines that you can actually draw and say this is right and this is not right. And when it comes to being a libertarian, you can't be a socialist and a libertarian at the same time. The two concepts are opposite of each other. You can't have a free market and a market controlled by the government, centrally planned by the government. The two things are opposite of each other. So if you think you can be a greenbacker, you really need to look at this again and really examine what the greenbackers are saying. Now, in reference to people who are just confused about it, that is, people who know this and are trying to actively infiltrate us, they know what they're doing. These people are not your friends. Let me see how I'm doing on time here, see if we're ready for a commercial. Well, I got a couple more minutes to rant before it's commercial time, so let me get back over here. There's another thing that you're always going to see with the greenbackers, and they're always going to throw this up at you. And this guy did in this Ron Paul video. They're always going to bring up, well, wouldn't it be nice if you could get, if you could borrow money at 0% interest? Really? 0% interest? And he kind of, in this video, he kind of hooks this socialist with this idea. Oh, yeah? Free money. Hey, everybody likes free money. Yeah, well, hey, guess what? That free money has to come from somebody. When you print fiat money and just start handing it out, you're taxing the other people who are holding that money. So it's not free, is it? It's stolen, isn't it? That's how it works. When you print up their process here, the greenbackers' process here, what they want to do is they want to have Congress control the money supply, and they want the government to print and distribute money, fiat money. So every time the government wants to spend more money, they just print more money. And these greenbackers actually think this is a good idea. Like somehow the government would restrain itself and the government wouldn't just go out and just start printing and spending like crazy. What would keep them from doing that? And they always say, oh, well, there'd be a constitutional amendment. Oh, okay, so they'd follow the Constitution. Congress would magically start following the Constitution now, even though they've broke it consistently for the last 240 years. Come on! Talk about a leap of faith. Why would I believe that Congress would somehow restrain itself on the one thing that Congress has never, ever once restrained itself on, spending money? Why would they do that? You hand these greenbackers their fantasy world with Congress in control of money, and you're going to see the destruction of money really, really quick. So what's Ron Paul's answer? Ron Paul is being an Austrian and definitely not supporting what these clowns are talking about. He says exactly what the rest of the libertarian community should be saying, and that is that the market should control the money supply. The market should decide what money is. If the market wants silver to be money, that's what it'll be. If it wants gold to be money, that's what it'll be. If it wants corn to be money, that's what it'll be. If it wants bitcoins to be money, then that's what it'll be. But only the market can determine that in a free society. The government cannot determine it. And laws coming down from the government to manipulate the economy and to manipulate the means of production, that's just socialism. That's all it is. Okay, now let me get back to this issue with the interest rate. So you want to dangle this bait in front of people. Oh, wouldn't you like to have loans at 0% interest? Wouldn't that be lovely? This falls back on something here. Now, I don't know where. Well, first off, it's greed. It's wanting something for nothing. But there is no such thing as getting something for nothing. So really what's happening, the greenbackers are really trying to get you to, they're trying to lure you into buying into their greenbacker philosophy. But really it's stolen money, because when the government prints up a lot of fiat money, the value of the value of the money in your bank drops every time the government prints more money. So what they're actually doing is they're taking the wealth out of your money and giving it to other people. That's what happens when they print money. So their 0% interest is not really getting money for nothing. It's taking the value of money from everybody else who's already got money and handing it to you at 0% interest rates. So really, That's theft. That's all it is. The greenbackers are supporting theft. All right, now where does this hate of interest come from? Because for some people, the desire for free money is what they are attracted to, this 0% interest nonsense. They want free money. But for other people, there are actually people who hate the idea that you can earn interest on money, or that you have to pay interest to borrow money. Now, I've come down to the point of where I believe that this comes from either one of two directions. It's either based on silly, antiquated superstitions, or it's a simple misunderstanding of the concept of time preference. So, without getting real deep into time preference, I want to hit this idea of the superstition end of this argument, because I think it's the easiest to tear apart. And if I have time, I might go into time preference, or I might do that on a different podcast or whatever. But I suppose I could touch time preference. Let's just do it really quick. Okay, so we have let's say I have a dollar. And let's say you need a dollar. You don't have a dollar. You would like to have a dollar. And I have a dollar. But I look at this dollar and I say, you know, I'm not really using this dollar right now. I would be willing to let go of this dollar if 1 year from now, if I could reach into my pocket and pull out the same dollar plus a dime, I would forego having the dollar now, so that I could have a dollar and a dime a year from now. Now, this is basic time preference. I would prefer to have more money later than the money that I have right now. Now, you might have somebody else who needs money right now, and they don't care about a year from now because they need the money right now. So they're willing to give more money over the course of time in order to get that money that they need right now. Okay, so that person would say, over the course of a year, I would rather give up $1.10 over the course of the year so that I can have that money now. And so this is a voluntary exchange between these two people. And what they're actually exchanging, you have to look at it this, that it's not necessarily money and interest. What they're exchanging is goods based on when their desire to have those goods and what the value of those goods are now as opposed to a year from now. So that's really all this is. This is a voluntary exchange between two individuals. Now, it's different when you bring something in like central banking and you have a government married to, you know, a Federal Reserve, where you have polluted the market with all these things, and it confuses the whole topic, and we get into, you know, interest rates that are not market driven, and we get into money devaluation, and all these things make the equation worse. But when you take out all the socialist influences and all the government influences, and you get down to what really is a loan, and what is interest, and what is what really is this in a free voluntary market, and the conclusion you come up with is that this is simply a voluntary agreement between two people based on time preference. If you hear Nikki in the background, that's her getting a drink of water from her bowl. That's her collar banging into the bowl. Okay, so I'm not going any further into the economic side of that. I'm not going to push time preference and go any further than that. Other than to say that's really all it is. It's in a free market society, interest is simply a way of determining. It's a price, really. It's the price for that time preference. Okay, now, on the superstition end of this, why do people hate interest rates? And I believe it is an antiquated superstition. Now, some people will say, no, in the Bible it says that you're not supposed to. Well, let's look, okay? In Deuteronomy, it actually says in chapter 23:19, it says, "Thou shalt not lend upon interest to thy brother, interest of money, interest of victuals, of food, interest of anything that is lent upon interest." And verse 20 says, "Unto a foreigner thou mayest lend upon interest, but unto thy brother thou shalt not lend upon interest. Okay, so that's in Deuteronomy, and that's pretty clear. Except there's a couple things. First off, now the person who will tell you that they believe word for word in the Bible, and that you absolutely have to follow word for word what's in that Bible, well, it says your brother, and I don't think you ought to charge your brother interest. But that says your brother. And then the oftentimes the argument will be, yeah, but that's talking about all those who are within the faith, all those who are, wait, didn't you just say that you believe the Bible word for word? That word says brother. That word does not say all those in the faith or all those. See, this was written for Hebrews. The book of Deuteronomy was actually based on three sermons that Moses gave. And so this is from a sermon of Moses that he gave just prior to his death, or just prior to the Israelites going into their promised land. And it says, thy brother. So now, if we're going to argue that what they were really talking about was among all the Hebrews, do not lend to another Hebrew with interest rate, well, then you've already decided that you're not going to believe the Bible word for word. Isn't that right? Because it says brother. It doesn't say your fellow Hebrew. It doesn't say you can charge interest to non-Jews, but you can't charge interest to Jews. And it certainly doesn't say Christians. So what is it? Are you going to believe the Bible word for word? Because if so, it says brother. And I don't think you ought to charge interest to your brother. I think you ought to try to help your brother. But if you don't believe the Bible, it absolutely has to be held word for word, then there's no reason to believe that we're held to this anyway. After all, you know, if you recall, it says in the New Testament when Jesus was when they were talking to Jesus, they said, you know, what if the law is really? And he said, you know what? I'm fulfillment of the law. And he said, all the law and the prophets can be wrapped up in this. And he handed them the golden rule. Now, that's the Christian position. That's the traditional Christian position, that Jesus, in his existence and in his teaching, fulfilled the law and the prophets. So if the law is fulfilled and all the law can be wrapped up in the golden rule, then you don't have to worry about Deuteronomy chapter 23, 19, and 20. But since we're talking about Deuteronomy chapter 19 and 20, let's just look at what else is in Deuteronomy in that area. Again, this is part of there's three sermons. Deuteronomy is made up of three sermons that Moses gave. And so this is all, what I'm about to tell you is all in one of those sermons. He talks about not charging your brother interest. He talks about how to handle the corpse of an executed man. In other words, what he says in here is that if a person is impaled on a stake as a capital offense, that you're supposed to get the corpse down off the stake before the sun goes down. Okay, so so we're in the same context as where he's telling you not to charge your brother interest on a loan. He's also telling you not to have bodies up impaled on stakes after sunset. He also says that if you have a wayward son that won't heed to the mother and the father, won't obey them, that they're to bring him before the men of the town, and the men of the town are to stone him to death. Now, that's in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 21, I believe. Yeah, chapter 21, verse 21. So right in the context, the same set of instructions says that if your son won't behave and is a defiant, heedless, and a glutton and a drunkard, that you should take him to the town elders and they should kill him. So if you believe that interest rates are evil and that nobody should be charging interest rates, then you also believe that your son ought to be stoned to death for being a drunkard? I mean, you have to have some level of consistency here, because this is in the same sermon. It's in the same area. It's the same series of instructions on how to live and how to behave yourself as the people of Israel go into their new land. Here's another part. Sorry about the background noise, but here's another part that's in there. It says that if the men of war go out in battle, and while they're fighting, other nations, if you see a captive that's a beautiful woman and you want her, then you can take her but you have to treat her nice. You have to let her prepare her fingernails, and you have to let her have a chance to trim her hair. And then if you decide you've had her for a while and you're done with her, you can't sell her as a slave. You have to turn her free. Now, that's the instructions in the same series of scriptures that we're talking about here about interest rates. So can we do this? The guys in Afghanistan, can they just snatch up a woman if they want her, keep her around for a month or so, trim up her hair, paint her nails, and then when they get done with her after about a month, they can turn her loose if they're tired of her. They don't have to take her as a wife, but they can't sell her as a slave. Are we going to accept that too? Are we going to put that on today's society? Because it's right there in Deuteronomy, right beside where it's talking about interest rates. Well, what else are we going to have here? Let's see. Oh, you don't wear, say, a summer blend in your clothing, do you? You don't have a blend of fabrics, do you? Because that's in the same section of Deuteronomy. Blending your fabrics is outlawed as well. So you can't have cotton and wool mixed together. You can't have mixed fabrics. See, so this is in the same area here. How about this? It's right in there in Deuteronomy chapter 21. It talks about if you have two wives and you like one of the wives, but you don't like the other wife. Okay, so you got two wives and you like one and you don't like the other, but you have children with both of them. You have children with the wife you like and the one you don't like. When you die and you set up your inheritance for your children, then there's rules here on how you treat the children of the wife that you didn't like and how you treat the children of the wife you did like. So then, let's take this to traditional marriage. Are we going to accept traditional marriage as being what's described in Deuteronomy chapter 21? Are we going to stick with that? Or isn't it possible that the entire book of Deuteronomy, I'm sorry folks, just doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. How about this one in Deuteronomy? In the same section, it tells you that you are not allowed to build a house without putting some type of barrier around the roof so that nobody will fall off the roof. Now, that's right in there. Building code. Libertarians, hear me out. The first building code right there in Deuteronomy. You can't build a house without putting a barrier around the roof so that people don't fall off your roof. How about that? Lovely building codes right there in Deuteronomy. So if you're using Deuteronomy as an excuse, or if and that's the primary spot in the Bible where it talks about a usury or about charging interest on a loan. So if you're going to use the Bible or Christianity or Judaism as an excuse that interest is evil, then I want to see your house and I want to make sure there's a handrail around your roof. Otherwise, you're a hypocrite. Does that make sense? All right, I think I've run over on my time now. Yes, I have. I've gone almost 10 minutes over on my time. So we better stick a commercial in here, and I'm going to calm down and breathe a little bit and stop preaching about Deuteronomy. Thanks, folks. I'll be right back in 2 minutes. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug-out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from BadQuaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help BadQuaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support BadQuaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do you do? Well, you go to badquaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks. Okay, folks, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial break. And hopefully I'll be a little bit calmer in this half. I tend to get a little out of control when I start preaching the word coming out of Deuteronomy there. Anyway, let's go in a different direction altogether. How about if we deal with a myth? Have you ever had this thrown at you? They always say something like, well, anarchy's never been tried, or anarchy's never worked. Okay, now, at what point does a myth become a lie? If we have something that people regularly believe, at what point... But they're confused. They're wrong. They believe something that they've been told. You believe it because you've been told it. You've been taught it as a child. It was taught to you in school. But at what point does that myth become a lie? Now, for instance, let's say the person tells you the myth. Well, the gods live up on top of this mountain. There are gods that live on top of this mountain. So there's your myth. Okay, so the skeptic says, I think I'll go climb the mountain and see these gods. So the skeptic goes and he climbs the mountain, and he can't find any gods. So he comes back down to the myth teller, and he's like, dude, I climbed the mountain. I went up there. There were no gods. Then the myth teller says, well, the gods are only on the mountain when the clouds cover the peak. So they're not up there all the time. They're busy doing other things. The way you can tell the gods are up there is because the peak is all covered in clouds. All right, so the skeptic goes up. He spends 2 months on top of the mountain in all kinds of weather. And he comes back down and he says, dude, I was up there the whole time. There were clouds. There were no clouds. There was rain. There was no rain. There were no gods. I didn't find any gods on top of this mountain. Well, then the myth believer says, well, you can only see the gods if you believe in the gods. Okay, so now this pattern repeats with each time the skeptic investigates, the believer will change the conditions of the myth. So you can never really disprove the myth because the myth teller changes the rules of the myth every time you narrow him down on something. All right, now here's another myth. Before Columbus, people believed the world was flat. No, they didn't. Now, this has been debunked over and over and over. Scholars and even common sailors knew the world was a sphere going back into antiquity. Now, maybe if you lived in central Germany and never seen the ocean, you might believe the earth was flat. But if you've ever been to the ocean, and if you've ever seen a ship coming toward you, especially if it's a ship with a tall sail, the first thing you see is the very tip top of the sail as it's coming towards you. And the closer it gets, the bigger, you know, the more of that mast starts to ease up above the horizon. And eventually you'll see the whole ship. But the fact that the first part of that you see is the very top of the mast, you're actually seeing the curvature of the earth there as the ship is coming towards you. And anybody who's ever been out in the desert far enough, out in a nice big flat desert, you can actually tell that the earth curves downward because across a great distance and you see mountains in a far distance across the desert, you don't see the base of the mountains, you see the tops of the mountains. And the reason why is because the earth is curved. Well, people have known about this going into antiquity. It wasn't the thing that Columbus was not trying to prove the earth was round. He was trying to prove the distance from Europe to Asia. And he was trying to prove that the distance was shorter than people believed and that it could be economically sailed back and forth. Now, there were other beliefs that there were things like giant waterfalls or, you know, sea monsters or whatever. But that's not the point. The point is that they actually knew the Earth was a sphere. Columbus did not. He was not presenting some crazy, wild, new idea. People knew about this. But yet, even today, this is taught and referenced over and over and over that people used to believe the world was flat. And that's just not true. Well, this idea that anarcho-societies have never been tried or have never succeeded, this is also, I don't know, where is it? Where do you make the divide? How many times can you debunk this nonsense and it still be considered just a myth? At what point are the statists who keep saying this over and over, at what point are they just lying? At what point are they not really caring to check out the facts, not really caring to check out the argument, that they're just saying this over and over, throwing it in our face, knowing that they're lying? I don't know. You know, for some, I believe they are lying. I believe they know the difference. But for most, I think they just, they blindly cling to this, they hold their faith to this myth because they're afraid to let go of it. They're afraid to, at the concept that that anarchy has worked in the past, works currently today. Anarchy, you know, there's all kinds of examples of how anarchy works today. But this idea that a whole society could live without a centralized government, it terrifies some people. When in fact, that's been the default form of society throughout humanity, of humanity throughout the ages. If you think, if you could look at a time scale, you know, just like they show you in school, where the Roman Republic existed from this time to this time, and the Roman Empire lasted from this time on the timeline to here, and this is where this empire took over, and this is where that empire existed, and we see this timeline, if we look across a timeline like that, and we see where the different empires existed throughout time, what we're not thinking about is all of the geographical areas of the Earth, and all of the cultures and all the people that live in those areas that were not affected by that particular state at that particular time. So, for example, if we think of the Roman Republic that existed, say, in 100 BC, and we mark that on our timeline that the Roman Republic existed, are we considering that almost all the rest of Europe was in a stateless condition? And they were not just wild barbarians, attacking each other and hanging from trees or living in caves. There were very complex societies throughout Northern Europe that existed entirely stateless for all of the 1,000 years that Rome existed. The vast majority of Europe was stateless for the entire 1,000 years that Rome existed. I'm repeating myself here for a reason. It's to keep in mind. Think of the Vikings, for example. The Vikings, from the time that there was a population explosion in Scandinavia in the late 700s AD. And that population explosion, by about 800 AD, caused a situation where there just wasn't enough local resources in Scandinavia to support the population. So they began migrating out in every direction, and they migrated using their latest invention that they had perfected, which was their Viking longboats. And these people moving out settled all over Northern Europe. And all of their functioning in their society was without a state. The Vikings essentially occupied land at one point in time. Let me count this up really quick to make sure. If you consider North America, Europe, Africa, and Asia. Yeah. At one point in time, Vikings were living on 4 continents without any centralized government. Now, to a certain extent, they, like specifically in when they invaded northern France, they almost immediately were converted to statists and immediately came in and began polluting themselves with the concept of statehood. But they did not do that in Ireland. They did to a certain extent in England. They did to some extent in Scotland. It took a while before the Vikings in modern day Russia really allowed statism to grasp their society. But it never really caught hold in Iceland or in Greenland, and clearly it didn't. There was no Viking state in North America. The whatever happened there is, of course, a matter of conjecture. But the point being that there are all kinds of examples throughout history of societies existing without a centralized government, without a central government based on aggression, without the classic thinking of how a state functions with the monopoly of aggression. There are all kinds of examples of culture lasting thousands of years. And so at what point in repeating the same myth over and over again does the myth simply become a lie? And do we just call them out on it and say, you know that's not true? If you just think about it, you know that's not true. You consider the Americas. Sure, there were states, there were central governments in Mexico, in parts of Central America, even down parts of South America were controlled by centralized governments. But vast amounts of South America were never, ever, ever controlled by central governments. And vast amounts of North America were never under central governments. If you consider the Native American cultures in North America, there's quite a bit of evidence that the Mississippian or the Hopewell cultures were statists. However, they were gone by the time that the European invasion started taking place, and the North American people were living in voluntary societies. Thomas Jefferson commented on this, on how he didn't understand exactly, that's his comments, he didn't understand exactly how they functioned, but he was amazed that they did function without an aggression-based government. And they did. This was one of the confusions when, let's say, in the early days when the European-based settlers would attempt to make a treaty, or when the U.S. government would attempt to make a treaty with the Native Americans, and they would get together people that they perceived as the chief or whatever terminology they used. These terminologies didn't exist in languages like Algonquin and stuff, but the English taped on, the English speakers, I should say, taped on these words and these titles onto the Indians. And so they would make an agreement, a treaty, and the European-based people would think, okay, well, now I've made a treaty with, say all these Shawnees have now made a treaty, and we can take part of Ohio. Well, no, you just made a treaty with the one or two Shawnees you talked to. Because the Shawnees existed in a voluntary society, no one or two or ten Shawnees could speak for all of them. There was no possible way they would accept that. So if you're making an agreement with Shawnees that are living in eastern Ohio along the Ohio River, and then you try to inflict that upon Shawnees living in the Great Miami River area, you're going to have a problem, because they're not going to recognize any authority of any other Shawnee other than the one that you're talking to at the moment. Because they were a stateless society, and yet they functioned. They had culture, they had language, they had art, they had all the things that we consider to be a part of culture. They had them without a centralized government. And I'm talking about the Shawnees, but this goes throughout all of North America. There are a few examples of where aggressive states existed, but the bulk of all natives in North America were stateless. And there was a problem even with the state-based natives, say, in Mexico, attempting to move northward. They really faced solid opposition in doing so and were never able to do that. Because especially in in that level of advancement as far as technology goes, a stateless society had very distinct advantages over a state-based society. So the Mexican empires were never successful at moving north, out of what we now call Mexico. Okay, so then what do we do with these people when they constantly bring this back up, that that a stateless society has never existed or never been successful? Well, you know, how old do you think humanity is? If you're one of these people I was talking to a minute ago that believe the Bible word for word, and they say, well, the earth is only, you know, 5,000, 6,000 years old or whatever, then, well, maybe we've got a different issue to talk about, and maybe we can address that separately. But if you believe the bulk of the evidence outside of the Bible, then humanity, as we know it today, has existed for a very long time, and yet there is no evidence that the state existed prior to about 9,000 or 10,000 years ago. So let me just repeat that. Humanity has lasted extreme amounts of time, but the state has only existed for 9,000 or 10,000 years. Prior to the state's existence, man figured out how to farm, how to trade, how to use gold for money. They figured out art. They figured out music. They had musical instruments. They had beer. They had wine. They had many of the things. And they developed all the way to the point of the Bronze Age before the introduction of the state. And where the state was, it was extremely limited, geographically speaking. The state was only in a couple of very tiny little spots as the rest of the world went into the Iron Age. So a good portion of the world, a good portion of humanity, went from the Stone Age all the way into the Iron Age without the existence of a state. All right, let me check my time here and see how I'm doing, because my voice is starting to give out. Now, I think one way or the other, I'm going to have to wrap it up. I'm going to have to make this a sort of a short podcast today. I apologize for that, but my voice is starting to give out on me. I do want to throw out one other thing really quick here, and that way I can just clear it off my notes and not have it floating from week to week and never getting to talk about it. I put a post in reference to this on Facebook, but I'm going to go ahead and run through it here as well, because I know a lot of the listeners are not Facebook people, so I wouldn't be a Facebook person if I had a choice. But anyway, all beside the point. Okay, so I'm going to read this through the way that I put it on Facebook. Fun facts about Baby Bush, the anti-gun president. And the source here is MAG News. MAG stands for Minds Advisory Group. It's a they go around all around the world and try to find, like, you know, anti-personnel mines that different governments have put out in places, and they try to find all kinds of explosives and things, and they try to destroy as much of them as possible in a safe manner. That's what the Mines Advisory Group does. Okay, according to their data, they say that 400,000 tons, I'll read that again, 400,000 tons of what they classify as small arms and light weapons were discovered and destroyed in Iraq since the invasion in 2003, and the vast majority of those were AK-47s and AK-47 ammo, which is 7.62 by 39 millimeter ammo. 400,000 tons equals 800 million pounds of primarily AK-47s. If you do the math real quick, you're going to find that you know, one AK-47 weighs about 11 pounds fully loaded, and a box of 1,000 rounds of 7.62 by 39 weigh about 40 pounds each. That means at 800 million pounds, you could have possibly 16 million AK-47s with 1,000 rounds each. And Baby Bush destroyed them rather than allowing them to come to the U.S. in the form of legal imports. If you think about the way when the Soviet Union dissolved and the former Soviet states immediately started selling their arms reserves into the Western market, and that's where we had all these wonderful AK-47s and SKSs coming into the American market. But that didn't happen because Bush had them destroyed. So whenever somebody tells you about, you know, anti-gun presidents, just keep in mind that George W. Bush destroyed more AK-47s and prevented them from coming into the U.S. market than, you know, all Democrats put together. So just keep that in mind. Okay, folks, I'm going to wrap it up with that. And for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And as always, thank you very much for listening, and thank you for those emails. Be sure and drop me an email at ben@badquaker.com. Thanks a lot, folks. Goodbye.